John Decker, our own White House correspondent, President Biden and the Japanese Prime Minister. Take it away, John.
Well, that's right, Jack. I'm on the South Lawn of the White House. You may hear some music in the background. We are getting ready for the welcoming ceremony for the Japanese Prime Minister. It's a full day of events here at the White House. The welcoming ceremony this morning, we'll have a meeting between President Biden and the Japanese Prime Minister Kishida. Following this welcoming ceremony, that will take place in the Oval Office. A joint press conference, Jack, that will take place in the Rose Garden in the early afternoon. More meetings following that. And then this evening will be a state dinner at the White House honoring Japanese Prime Minister Kishida. The entertainment for tonight's dinner, Jack, someone I know you're pretty impressed by, that's Paul Simon. So for those lucky enough to be invited to the state dinner, they'll get to hear the musical talents of Paul Simon. So quite a day on tap as it relates today to this state visit.
All right, John, make it a good one. Watch out for the Easter eggs in the east on the lawn if there's any left. Thank you. Hey, real quickly, before we go to a break, Chris Stawaz joining us. And he, Chris is an awesome dude because what he does in the fight against the opioid overdose, and I'll just tell you, because CJ, you and I were talking before the break because J-Dog's off, and you said, who's Chris and what's American Medical Response? They're the folks you call, the EMTs out there. Talk about unsung heroes. Talk about veterans. They're that frontline 911. And Chris is the, I think, the Northeast Regional Director for AMR. What he does is he tracks the opioid overdose deaths and numbers. And you heard Mike Pomp talk about in the news this morning. Chris joins us live. Good morning, Hampshire, the Pulse of the Nation. Thank you, Chris, for the latest snapshot at a problem that I don't think is getting any better. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jack. Thanks for having me. And just want to echo thank you for your work for veterans. My father-in-law is a Navy veteran. He was in the Seabees. He's actually stationed in Cuba. And he's got some great stories from the old days. But, yeah, you do tremendous work there. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate that.
You're absolutely right. You know, we had some success the last several months. As I sent out the numbers, we are well below the 12-month average, November, December, January, February. But in March, we kicked back up to right around the 12-month average. So we had 70 overdoses between Manchester and Nashua last month. What's most concerning, however, is the number of deaths. There were 10 deaths, which is a pretty significant percentage. You know, we have less overdoses, but unfortunately, our deaths are remaining the same. So the percentage of people dying from this is actually increasing, which is very alarming. That's our number one goal, is to prevent death. And unfortunately, we're seeing it going in a bad trend right now.
Chris, is that because of the potency of the synthetic fentanyl, the toxicity? We have John Dueno, the DEA, on the show talking about this. The cartels that will finish producing this and distribute it from Mexico, is there are two that the DEA has identified. They don't care how strong it is. I've had people ask when we did that special on addiction, the three-hour town hall. Should have had you on, actually, in hindsight. But they said, don't they care that they're killing off their customers? And John at the DEA said, no, they don't give a damn.
Yeah, John's absolutely right. And he's really good at explaining how, you know, you could put some fentanyl in on a piece of paper and spread it out into four or five different sections, and each part of it will have a different potency level. There is absolutely no quality control at the synthetic fentanyl factory. It could be what's a lethal dose for me could not be a lethal dose for you. And the hard part is we have so many people in recovery, which is great. But once you enter recovery, your tolerance for your previous amount of fentanyl that your body could handle, let's say, goes way down. So if you relapse, if you have to go and use again, it's a completely different dose that your body is going to be able to control. And a lot of people, they use in private because they're embarrassed, they're having a relapse. They stop breathing and they die. It's a very, very dangerous situation.
Yeah, and I worry because people that might be first-time users or bump into the drug because it's put, the DEA said they put it into other stuff, like you don't think you're, you know, not just buying a finger of fentanyl, it might be laced or put into other drugs. People may not even be aware they're ingesting fentanyl, right? We had someone on, Chris Stawaz with American Medical Response from the State Police Crime Lab, who you work with, not long ago, said that of all the toxicology stuff they do, fentanyl kept showing up, even if that wasn't the direct cause that the person knew had taken. Fentanyl was almost in everything, is what I was being told.
You're absolutely right. We encounter people on a regular basis who will even be smoking marijuana and become unconscious. We revive them with Narcan. They wake up and say, listen, I am not a fentanyl user. I don't use fentanyl. I only use marijuana or I only use cocaine. Yet they were woken up with Narcan, indicating that there was an opioid in there. So you just have no idea. You have to assume that it's in everything. You really do.
Yeah. All right. Again, so the numbers, what I'm hearing, Chris, to sum up, 70 opioid overdoses in the two largest cities, but 10 deaths, and the numbers are trending up.
That's correct. We're hopeful that we'll go back down. You know as well as I do, a lot of people working on this, a lot of great people, a lot of wonderful programs that are out there. But unfortunately, the cartels, as you mentioned when talking to John Delena, the cartels are always one step ahead of everybody, unfortunately, and they are very good at what they do, and it's a catch-up game from the standpoint of first responders, law enforcement, and the recovery community. But doesn't mean we'll give up the fight. We're going to keep going, keep the pedal down, and do what we do.
All right. Appreciate it. Chris Dewaz, American Medical Response, talking about the latest opioid overdose numbers. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
Brad Card, live in Washington, one of our political analysts and all-stars, Card and Associates. Good morning, Brad.
Hey, Jack, you love paying more for things. I know you do.
You know, I talk to families, I'll tell you, Brad, the veteran community, and they'll say, Jack, I was away for a while, and now I'm back, and I'm working full-time. So is my partner. And, like, every third week of the month, we run out of money. Everything's just so expensive. Why are they telling us inflation's coming down? I'm like, you're not alone. And then, Brad, and what sucks as well is, here in New England, Brad, I know you spent time here. You're from here originally. You worked in New Hampshire and lived here, but now you're in other states more. The electricity rates, when you get like on top of like the third week and you get your, I don't want to pick on the utilities, you get your bill on top of groceries and mortgage and rent, and then all of a sudden you look at it and it's like $480, not $189, you know?
Yeah. And you're talking about rooms and meals taxes. You're talking, toll increases, and it's tough.
All right,
but Joe Biden's going to tell you everything's fine, so don't worry about it.
Yeah,
you're doing better.
No, and I think you're even seeing some people on the left side of national media say you better stop focusing on infrastructure and Bidenomics and your Inflation Reduction Act and start realizing families are hurting and they're getting really
people
up.
People who made horrible choices. And took out loans, voluntary loans for college, are having their loans forgiven, which is just ridiculous.
Is that just me, Brad, or is it almost like transparently trying to buy votes from young people because you're
it's offensive?
You're underwater. Yes, you're offensive. Underwater. Young people don't want you, even Democrats, to be president again. So buy their vote.
It's offensive. I mean, Jack, that's why when you take a look at polling, you talk about right track versus wrong track of a country. For the direction of the country, the president is upside down by almost 39 percentage points. Upside down.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. People disapprove of the way the president is handling his job by a spread of 15%. Mm. So look at what it's going to take for the president to – and then add in the border, Jack. Add in the southwest border, which is, I've said is 1, 2, and 3 issue in this next election, in my opinion.
Yeah.
He's just so far upside down, and it's almost like he doesn't want to win. He is just tone deaf to taking any kind of executive action.
Yet
he takes 92 executive orders to repeal items.
I know.
From the previous administration down the southwest border.
But you know what it is, Brad? If he secures the border, which he can through executive order, AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, goes crazy because she wants people coming in. Hey, Brad, though, you just said something I want to touch upon for a moment. I think it's more complicated than that. Not complicated. You just said it's like he doesn't want to win. But here's what I don't understand, or do understand. He's a politician. If nothing else, Joe Biden has been a politician his whole adult life. So he will move, bend, flex. And I think there's a cadre of people in his power base, White House and reelection, who truly are left of left. And I think he just doesn't know which way to go because he's not a very strong leader. And I mean, I'm not being critical.
There's a little bit of weekend at Bernie's, right? I mean, they're just propping him up on certain things and they direct him what to do. It's sad.
Yeah,
it really is sad.
I think they tell him, okay, Hamas attacks Israel on October 7th. Israel is our only ally. You have to stand strong with Israel. When the poll numbers start to look bad with the prolonged death and violence in Palestinians in Gaza, they start saying, "Oh no, no, no! You gotta tell Netanyahu to stop this." As far as the border goes, we don't have a crisis. Don't worry about it. You don't have. It's just the right. It's the Republicans making a crisis here at the southern border.
Inflation's not real.
Yeah, inflation's coming down. We're doing well. The inflation reduction. And I think he just listens, going, okay. And then he goes out, and until they tell him, you got to turn this way again. It's pure. There's no conviction, is what I'm saying. It's just pure politics.
Well, Jack, it is politics, and you know, but both sides are playing. I mean, I hate to say it, if you're frustrated with the political climate, I think you're in the majority now. I think that you have a right to be. I think Republicans have been very dysfunctional. Democrats are dysfunctional. The president is dysfunctional. Your government is not working for you. You're giving money away to people who make dumb decisions and taking on student loans when they could have gone to their local community colleges for next to nothing. And then, by the way, those people who chose not to go to college and work in a trade are being penalized now and have to pay for the people who made dumb decisions and take out more loans than they could handle. It's just all that type of stuff is wrong, and people are frustrated, and they have a right to be frustrated. And I just don't know if it ends. And I hate to say it, Jack, even on the abortion issue, you know, Democrats are saying, I think what the Supreme Court did on Roe v. Wade was correct, and that it's a states' rights decision. They kicked it back to the states, and now states are determining. And quite frankly, when abortion is on the ballot in states, including in ruby red states,
mm-hmm.
pro-abortion, pro-choice measures win on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So they see a hard right push to ban abortions totally as being wrong and outrageous. But they also don't like this, have an abortion right up until the ninth month. I mean, they don't like that. And so there has to be some common sense in this. And right now we don't have common sense in politics. It's been terrible.
Who's Trump going to pick as a running mate, and when is he going to make the announcement?
Going to pick you, Jack.
No,
I'm sorry good. To burst your bubble and announce it. Now,
I think he's going to pick you because he says if I can get Card and I can run with Card, because he's been such a critic of mine, I'm going to show that I'm magnanimous. No, seriously, what's the timetable? And I'm kind of losing. I kind of felt like it was going to be Tim Scott of South Carolina for a while. Now I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've been pretty steady on this. I think the smart pick for him is Elise Stefanik. Congresswoman, she's the Republican conference chair.
Mm-hmm. She did great in that Harvard, you know, the university questioning.
Yeah. Well, she's very young. She was the youngest member of Congress for a while. And she has been in Congress now for quite a while. She's in leadership, the Republican leadership. She's conference chair. I think that she's pandered to him a little bit too much, and it bothers me. I hate the statement that people that were arrested after punching police officers in the face and macing them and smashing windows in the Capitol that she's willing to call them, like Donald Trump is willing to call them, political hostages. That's offensive to me. But I think that she is really smart. I think that she had a history of being very smart on legislation in Congress. Outside of what I would call somewhat pandering to President Trump. But she makes a lot of sense. She's a woman. She's young. She will appeal to a younger audience, which is smart. And she is a real conservative. I think that she would be a good pick for Donald Trump. Byron Donald down in Florida, I think that he thinks that he's in the mix. So maybe he is. African-American, Southwest Florida. Southwest Florida, Ruby Red, Lee County.
It won't happen, but you see the other day Trump even said, you know, what about RFK Jr.? You never know.
Huh. Wow. That would be interesting. I have a funny feeling he might anger some of the base if he did that. Because he's certainly not a Republican.
Interesting.
But, you know, like, I'm not necessarily convinced Donald Trump is a Republican. So maybe that would be something out of the box he would do. I guess the real thing is about Donald Trump, what he's going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really knows. I mean, I don't even know if Donald Trump knows. I bet he changes his mind between now and the time that he announces somebody. He's going to change his mind five times.
He might. All right. Bruins came up short last night against the Canes.
Oh, it was terrible, Jack. They looked horrible. They did not play well.
Give Monty a call. All right, Brad Card, Card and Associates, Card and Associates political analyst and officer. Thank you, Brad.
see you.
And Chuck Morse is a former Senate president, former U.S. Senate candidate, but he's a gubernatorial candidate, Republican, running for governor. Chuck Morse joins us. Good morning, New Hampshire. Back on the show, The Pulse of an Age. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Jack.
Well, I just talked about the fentanyl numbers. You put out a release that was interesting, talking about strengthening our state sort of as a stronger defense to strengthen New Hampshire. Can you elaborate about what your plan is?
Sure. And you started by talking about the border, which, you know, I think that's where it starts. I mean, the progressives think that offering, you know, initiatives like amnesty and other programs that are funding these people when they get to our country are causing these people to get here. I can assure you, as part of my plan as governor, New Hampshire will not be a welcome mat for illegal immigrants, and we won't be providing them funding with taxpayer dollars. And that's the starting point. I mean, beyond that, I think the legislature is doing a great job of starting to clarify things like there'll be no sanctuary cities in New Hampshire, and we certainly are working on things to work with law enforcement. We need to get people back into it.
What do you say to Democrats who don't support ending sanctuary cities and say people like you are just trying to make this an election issue, that the immigration and border crisis and undocumented stuff is not as bad as you're making it?
Oh, it is bad, Jack. I mean, the number in New Hampshire, we don't know, right? Whether it's 10, 15,000 people that have got in here, you can't define illegal. We don't know illegal or migrants that have got into our state already. And I think the next disaster that happens will shut those people right up, because the fact is we need to shut the door in this country. Part of my plan was supporting a president that will shut the southern border and then run for governor and make sure that we shut the northern border in our state and stop the drugs from coming in. I mean, part of the plan that I announced was the fact that I do think we need to make stronger drug laws. I mean, those same Democrats don't believe we need to do that either.
Well, Chuck Morse, I'm just going to point this out. For years doing the show from law enforcement experts and DEA, no disrespect to the northern border, I'm hearing that most of the synthetic fentanyl that is causing these overdose and death numbers are coming through the same classic distribution routes through Massachusetts, through cities like Lawrence and Lowell, up into the state, up into Portland, Maine. And how do we secure the southern border here, if you will, from fentanyl?
Yeah, and we've been talking about this, and we're not showing any disrespect to the northern part, Jack, and neither are you. I mean, the fact is, it's coming through the north down here. I've worked with the sheriff. We've been over to interviews with him. You know, when he tells me that they're tripling the amount of arrests they're doing down here, and we ask the question,
I understand.
What does that mean? He's telling me that that's not even 10% of the drugs coming into our state.
Well, I understand. I'm not saying that the north is not a porous in parts of it, but I'm just saying, you know, right up 93, right up Everett Turnpike, you know, people that are going to drive in with drugs. How do we stop this deadly foe? Does it go back to the southern border? Do you think the president needs to declare the Mexican cartels distributing this stuff, terrorist organizations? How do we stop the flow from the source?
All of the above. That's why I supported President Trump. I think the border needs to be closed, Jack, and send that strong message. I think New Hampshire needs to send a stronger message that if you're dealing in fentanyl, we're going to treat you like the murderers you are. I mean, we're a small state. We can't afford to have weak laws here, and we need to strengthen them and send strong messages. The first message is we should all vote in November to make sure that border is getting closed in the South.
Yeah. Totally unrelated to fentanyl, just a question, because I had some of our analysts, well, Senator Bradley on Friday, he's talked about it. Governor Sununu talked about it last week, is the House is going to be releasing a bill to legalize marijuana for recreational use. It will go to the Senate. It will probably change there. Governor Sununu said he doesn't really like the idea of it. He's willing to look at it, but not the way it came out of the House Finance Committee. You've been a Senate president. If you were governor, regardless of how that bill looks, would you sign a bill to legalize marijuana for greater recreational use, whether it's three locations or 30, through the state liquor, however it's going to be controlled? But in general, would you sign something, or are you open-minded to it, or do you think that's bad?
No, I've made it clear that I wouldn't support signing that. I think the fact that we do have this crisis with fentanyl right now is just proving the point that adding to it and having marijuana as part of the crisis. I listened to a gentleman speak on this morning. It is a crisis, and marijuana is right at the tip of the iceberg. We can't let it happen in New Hampshire.
You know, it's not on my talking points because you came out. I did want to play off the release of securing the defenses of New Hampshire, or however your press release yesterday from your campaign, Chuck Morris, Republican gubernatorial candidate. But I want to come back to something else I mentioned earlier. Inflationary numbers are out, 3.5% up. You and everyone knows things are too expensive. But the other thing is, and it does get political, and I don't think it should, we pay, and this is not new, some of the highest electricity rates in the country. And it is bankrupting some families. You know, when you get that bill, not to pick on Eversource or Liberty or New Hampshire Co-op or Unitil, when a family of two or three or a couple people in the house, beyond groceries, rent, lease, regular stuff, health insurance, a little curveball, unexpected expenses until the paychecks come, and then they get a bill from the utility for $489 versus $189. What? Yeah. How can we honestly lower our electricity cost in this state? I know it's something you've looked at as Senate President, but if you're governor, how do we actually do this, Senator?
Well, let me just make it clear. Governor Sununu's done a great job of not letting anything drive up those costs. Beyond that, we have to get energy to the Northeast. We have to support a candidate for president that's going to let that happen. We need to make sure that we get a pipeline through New York. I mean, these are all things that I paid attention to since I started this race, because I'm going to support a candidate that's going to do that. And that's the only way to drive down the rates up here, is to get more energy up into our region. And I support that. But I also support the fact that we as a government cannot add to those problems. And that's what Governor Sununu has done for quite some time now.
Finally, if you are successful in the nominee, Kelly Ayotte, one of your main challengers, regardless of who the Republican nominee is, I've asked you this before, but it's clear now with former President Trump, President Biden talking about it. Trump comes out Monday, total eclipse day, if you will, and talks about his position on abortion. States like Arizona, you and I know, hot button issue for a lot of voters is going to be abortion rights. New Hampshire does have a law, no restrictions through the first six months, only in the last trimester. What are you going to say, or how do Republicans respond that Chuck Morris favors an abortion ban? Chuck Morris, Kelly Ayotte, Republicans favor an abortion ban. How do you respond?
Well, first of all, I agree with President Trump that we leave it up to the states. And second of all, we've taken a proactive approach in our state by passing sensible legislation. You know, over 70% of the people agree with what we passed on abortion. I think the question you have to ask the other side, Jack, is, what's acceptable to them? Because we passed a law, the first time in 50 years, that basically says they can have abortions in the first 6 months consulting with their doctor and their family. What's acceptable to them? Abortions up until birth or even after birth? Ask them that question, because the Republicans put out a plan that the public in general, 70% of them, accept, and I thought it was leadership. And I certainly did it with the fact that I have a wife and daughter who voice an opinion to me all the time, and I respect it. So I think we've done a great job.
All right. If people want to learn more, best way is how?
Chuck Morris, ForNewHampshire.com.
Senator, thanks. We'll get you back again soon. And also looking forward to a debate with your Republican challenger in August sometime here in our studios. Thank you, sir.
Oh, we're looking forward to it. Thank you.
Aaron Rao, Missouri News Radio national correspondent, will testify or attest to that. Good morning, Aaron.
Yes, we are seeing the million-dollar cities by state on the rise. There's over $550 million cities. So a million-dollar city would be a city that the typical home, like you described in Rye, is over $1 million. New Hampshire actually has three of these cities. And California, just to give you some context here, obviously a very large state, has 210 of these cities. New York has 66. Jersey has 49. Florida, 32. Massachusetts, 31. But the list goes on and on. Essentially all over the country, from Wisconsin to Maine to Ohio to Arizona, we are seeing a rise in these million-dollar cities. And you said it much nicer than I would. I've been on Zillow. I've looked at some of these houses, and you're like, that's a dump. Why is it so expensive?
Yeah.
Like, I just think, like, objectively, some of these things, you're like, what? What are they doing? Who is going to buy this? I guess someone, because what we're seeing is this lock-in effect. That's what experts are calling this. It's the result of mortgages being locked in at 2 or 3%. No one's moving from that. So it deters the homeowners from listing their properties. That keeps the supply limited. That keeps prices elevated.
Well, I don't know about you, and you're looking at this nationally, but the question I hear and ask a lot is, who are these people moving here? And they're coming from other states like where you live, or New York, or California. They're getting out of Dodge to move here, and they don't view a $1 million home as an obstacle. But good luck to the people that live in town that are generational or working in the hospitality or public safety or teaching or healthcare industry who can't. They look at this, go, I can't spend $1 million in that home and then spend another $200,000 or $300,000 fixing it up, because even if I put down a third, my mortgage rate, you know, I'm going to be paying $4,000 a month to live there, and I can't do it. And I people are coming in and still buy. What they're doing, and also on the seacoast of New Hampshire, Aaron, in Portsmouth, for example, there are cases of people coming in, spending $3 or $4 million for an old home that's sitting with an ocean view. And I said this yesterday, so I'm sorry, but I tend to be a tad contrarian. I'm not getting political with you, Aaron. But they will talk about climate change and carbon footprints, and they go to the town, they go that, they have a lot of money, and they'll tear down that house they paid $3 million for that might have had a, you know, 1,400 square foot footprint on the property, and they build a they build like a 4,000 square foot home, and that might cost $4 million additional to the $2 or $3 million they paid.
Yes, exactly. You see that a lot. And you see it like in any town in New England, you can see it for the most part. Like, you'll see a new home and an old home, and you're like, wow, that's double the size, the new home. And I'm not even talking like the fanciest of the fancy. It's just that everything is bigger now. You know, a middle class home was just, yeah, like you said, around like 1,400 square feet. It's now 4,000. And it's just, our expectations have changed. And the idea, I preach it from the rooftops, I will continue to, wage growth, wage growth, wage growth. That is what we need to remedy this. It is not what we are getting. And what you just explained with, you know, someone coming in, swooping up this property and then remodeling it or doing it. And then if you don't have wage growth for the folks on the ground who have lived there their whole life, it's going to be a big problem. And this is what creates, you know, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. And the further you get from the middle class, the less civil society sticks together.
All right. Aaron Rial, NBC News Radio national correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks.
Rory O'Neill, NBC News Radio national correspondent. Rory, no surprise, inflation numbers up 3.5%.
Yeah, that's the year-over-year number. It was a bit hotter than expected, which is why Wall Street is hurting today. As we speak, the Dow is down 437 points because there is less likelihood that the Fed will lower rates, certainly not in June, as many had expected. We'll be lucky if they start to lower rates in September, judging by some of these numbers.
Yeah.
There were some encouraging numbers inside the numbers. The cost at the grocery store have stabilized. It's the cost of eating out that's really gone up. And auto insurance premiums up 22% year over year. Something else keeping that inflation number a little bit sticky.
All right, Rory O'Neill, NBC News Radio national correspondent. Thank you, Rory.
Thanks, Jack.